Yesterday morning, three families were pulled off a plane set to for deportation. So that was a big victory. And all of these clients, as I said, have bona fide asylum claims.
You know, the U.S. is a signatory, Barbara Hines, to the U.S. Convention Against Torture. These people, many of them are fleeing horrific violence in their own countries. Is it against the law for the U.S. to deport them?
I think the problem with this is that many of the women are either unrepresented or they have substandard immigration lawyers. And it's very difficult for in an adversarial system that we have, which many countries do not have, to present asylum and Convention Against Torture claims. But yes, we are a signator not only to the Convention Against Torture, but to the Convention on the Status and Protection of Refugees. And I think that our government is not complying with those international norms.
Of course, we'll continue to follow this issue. Barbara Hines, longtime immigration lawyer, and Katie Shepard, managing attorney for Cata Pro Bono Project in Dilley, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of finance and operations, as well as a director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and the time is 5 p.m.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Sean. Or is it the other way around?
Who cares? It's radio. Or podcast on the radio.
Is that a band?
No, that's TV on the radio. Pitch our show already.
Oh, yeah. Listen to our show.
Can you elaborate?
Listen to our show, please.
Sweet mercy, I'll do it. Our show is called Upside Down Trodden. It's informative and entertaining talk about issues important to the effort to create a more sustainable, more peaceful, and more equitable world for all life on the planet. We want to inspire you to think critically, feel deeply, and ask questions.
And we want to have a little fun along the way.
That's true.
You can find...
Can I say it?
You can find...
Can I say it?
Yeah.
Don't interrupt me again.
I won't.
You can find... Come on!
You can find us at kboo.fm/upsidedowntrodden.
Turning power inside out never sounded so good, especially on
KBOO Portland.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2016 KBOO Artist in Residence are due February 12th at 5 p.m. More information and application materials are at kboo.fm/AIR2016.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the officer who arrested police accountability activist Sandra Bland in Texas last year is indicted on charges of perjury, while the family of the late activist is calling for charges of murder instead.
Cracks down on students organizing against armed security guards on campus.
And the city of Troutdale plans a focused effort against sex trafficking in East County.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 8th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Students at Portland State University say they're being threatened with expulsion by administrators over their protests against implementation of the university's new armed campus police squad. KBOO's Jamie Partridge spoke with Alyssa Pagan, a member of the PSU Student Union, about the recent PSU board meeting in which students tried to keep the panel from cutting off public comment.
What demands did you bring to the board?
There were a few. Among them was, of course, disarm PSU and a $15 minimum wage for all campus workers and for the breaking of ties with Aramark, which has its roots in the prison industrial complex. They are the chief food providers for private prisons in this country, mm-hmm. and we don't think that there is any good reason for them to also be working at our public university.
And there were a number of students and faculty that continued the public comment despite the board wanting to cut it off. And then what happened?
Right. So we decided that the public comment was not long enough. There were hundreds of people in the room that showed up, in the very tight room, mind you, who showed up based on flyers that were put out, event pages that were put out online for people to know that this is happening, who probably otherwise would not know that it's happening. The public comment, by the way, the official public comment, by the way, was extremely damning. No one that sat on the public comment had anything positive to say about the Board of Trustees and particularly President Vim Bevel. It was pretty shocking to everyone in the room, the kind of seething anger and disappointment that people were expressing to the board and to the president. And we felt like that there was not nearly enough time. Enough people did not speak. So one of the members of the student union initiated a mic check. We all followed suit and proceeded to actually stand in front of the board members who were facing the audience and did not allow for them to conduct their business. And we decided that the public comment would continue. And we asked people that were in the audience to come up and continue to express their discontent. And they most certainly did. We continued to occupy the meeting and have a public dialogue for hours after the board actually decided that they were going to up and leave, and they did.
And so the board left, but they're charging you or warning you and how many other students?
I'm still actually trying to get a count. This letter just came out yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there are at least four of us, and we're going to get an official count. Because of our sacrifice and our action, we have people from all over that want to support us and our work, including people at the National Lawyers Guild, and we greatly, greatly appreciate that support.
That was Jamie Partridge and Alyssa Pagan of the Portland State University Students Union.
Violence broke out at the Malheur Federal Wildlife Reserve Wednesday night. Lewis Arthur, leader of a citizens group called Veterans on Patrol, said one of his three-person crew was hospitalized after being punched in the face by one of the Arizona occupiers on site with Ammon Bundy, son of statist Cliven Bundy. Arthur said his intent was to remove women, children, and Ryan Payne, one of the most prominent occupiers, from the compound. Others inside tell a different story. They say that Arthur initiated a scuffle when he assaulted a guard as he tried to enter the compound. Reports say there's a long-standing personal tension between Payne and Arthur, which may have contributed to the altercation. In a news conference yesterday, the Malheur County Sheriff politely asked the group to leave the reserve. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has also weighed in. She said it's time for the standoff to end.
After this December's record-setting rainfall, dozens of residents from Oregon City are still without homes due to landslide dangers. Approximately 50 families living in two large apartment complexes received mandatory evacuation orders the day before Christmas. Of those families, at least 30 are still trying to find new housing, according to Clackamas County officials. No trespassing and road closure signs remain up at the Forest Edge and Berry Hill Park apartments. entrance, blocking access to units most threatened by the slides. A total of 41 apartments were evacuated at Forest Edge, with another 10 units affected at Berry Hill Park. Both complexes are perched on the steep slopes on or just above Newell Creek Canyon in Oregon City. Many of the displaced initially found shelter provided by the American Red Cross at Oregon City High School. That shelter closed January 3rd. The complex's management has told residents that an engineer will be on site soon to assess what can be done to mitigate future slides. With declarations of emergency issued by both Clackamas County and Oregon City set to expire in coming days, it remains unclear what will happen to the evacuated structures.
Seven staff members and one teenage volunteer at the Oregon Zoo were infected with tuberculosis after exposure to infected elephants. According to the Oregonian, the zoo workers developed a latent form of tuberculosis without symptoms following an outbreak starting in 2013 among the zoo's elephants. The outbreak was linked to three bull elephants, Packy, his son Rama, and Tusco. Tuberculosis, TB, is a respiratory disease that spread through the air when a person, or in this case an elephant, coughs, sneezes, or otherwise spreads the bacteria. About 5% of captive Asian elephants in North America are infected. Oregon Zoo elephants are checked annually for TB. The first case of TB popped up in May 2013 when a test on Rama was positive. The other two elephants tested positive over the next year. All three animals were put on a months-long round of treatment and the zoo enacted safety measures. The zoo personnel who developed the disease had close contact with the elephants. Following the infections, county epidemiologists launched an investigation to identify any human cases. Health officials identified 118 people who may have been at risk due to close contact with the animals. Though TB is highly contagious, health officials say the three infected elephants did not spread the disease to visitors, including those who attended one of Rama's painting parties in which he created splatter paintings. The outbreak has changed testing among zoo staff. Now employees with close contact with the elephants are tested more than just once a year, which is standard for all zoo employees across the country. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals said in a statement that the infections confirm that the risk to human health posed by captive elephants is serious.
The city of Troutdale might set a new Oregon standard for local community response to sex trafficking. On KBOO this morning, Mayor Doug Doust said the city is planning a coordinated effort among community groups and law enforcement to crack down on the sexual exploitation of minors. I spoke this morning with Troutdale City Councilor Larry Morgan. He explained why.
One thing that we're seeing now kind of reemerge is community policing, a lot more re-engagement in neighborhood watch. There's some things that the legislature can do to kind of help local communities get a better handle on this. But in cities that in many ways are interdependent on one another, working together is crucial. Faith-based initiatives, nonprofits, local charities, the Catholic Association and other, the Urban League, they're becoming more involved on this because you have, a population as an African-American that is disproportionately affected by this particular plight. And it's got to stop, but it's going to take all of us to come together to end this.
All right. How is it the African American community is disproportionately affected?
Well, in the metro region specifically, the PSU study showed about 469 youth involved, average age being 15, the youngest being an 8-year-old. Overwhelmingly, and as the mayor had said, but in Portland, 96% of them are female, identify as female. 40% are Caucasian, 27% are African American. Yet, inside of that, you have an issue where the minority population of African Americans in Multnomah County and in Oregon is 5% and 2% respectively. So, but yet they equate to, in this case, almost 30% of the overall people engaged and affected.
Morgan cited results of a Portland State University study examining trafficking victims under age 18 who were served by either the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division or the Sexual Assault Resource Center between 2009 and 2013. The Troutdale City Council will hold a work session on the issue Tuesday, January 26, starting at 6 p.m. at City Hall in Troutdale, followed by a full meeting of the council in which they will discuss a resolution on the issue.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, autistic adults talk with host Pamela Santos about what acceptance means, why awareness is not enough. That's followed by Hard Knock Radio at 7. Tomorrow's weather, overcast with occasional rain, high near 44 degrees and a low of 33 degrees. On this day in history, in 1877, Crazy Horse fought his last major battle against U.S. cavalry in Montana Territory. After defeating General George Custer at the Little Bighorn the previous year, Crazy Horse and his fellow Oglala Sioux and Northern Cheyenne warriors were targeted by federal troops who attacked their camp in a blizzard. Crazy Horse held the cavalry back as the vulnerable women, elders, and children escaped, but the tribe surrendered months later at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. Crazy Horse died later that year. The quote of the day is from Chief Crazy Horse. A very great vision is needed, and the person who has it must follow as the eagle seeks the deepest blue of the sky.
Islamophobia and its impact on the Pacific Northwest brought a full house to the City Club of Portland today. Speakers from the Islamic community included activists, academics, and students, all speaking on their experiences dealing with discrimination in Portland. The panel took questions from the audience. Here's an excerpt of today's session, which took place at the Sentinel Motel in downtown Portland.
My question is, can there be a statement by religious and community leaders in the Muslim community strongly condemning or declaring a fatwa against ISIS and other terrorists?
So the religious leaders that you talk about, then there's very often very little agreement among Muslim religious leaders and Muslims in general, because there's no clear hierarchy, institutional hierarchy in Islam. But one place in which there has been a great deal of consensus, it's historically unprecedented, is in relationship to ISIS. So if that's not heard, I'm not sure what else Muslims can worldwide, not just to mention the community, could do, because there's no group that has come out. Everyone from Shiis in Iran, Ibadis in Oman, Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia have spoken against ISIS. There hasn't been anyone who's stepped up to say, like, oh, you know, ISIS is acceptable. So there is exactly what you're asking for. And it's ironic that we keep thinking about ISIS as being representative of Islam when the overwhelming majority of Muslims worldwide had said this is not representative.
Three international Islamic organizations, and they represent, you know, mainstream Muslims, which means almost 95%. The Organization of Islamic Conference, which is affiliated, most majority Muslims countries are affiliated with, the European Council of Muslims Organizations, the Islamic Society of North America, all of them issued and signed over 180 Muslim scholars. And I was one of the people, you know, as a civic leader, signed in the national conference in Chicago, in Michigan. 180 Muslim American leaders have signed, you know, a condemnation against ISIS. I think it is very important to understand, in again back to Edward Said's book covering Islam and Orientalism, there are people in the media intentionally want to isolate the Muslim voice, you know, of condemnation of extremism, you know, and violence. And I think it is very important also to acknowledge, you know, there are people in the media that are trying their best, you know, to have Muslims to have that voice. But the majority of them are not interested when they see Muslims engaging in a peaceful, constructive way. But all these international bodies have condemned ISIS. And it is very important, you know, when we are going to accept that Muslims are like anybody else. When you see a Christian fundamentalist, you know, going, you know, to clinics and attack, you know, these clinics, or Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma bombing, you know, or Jimmy Jones or David Koresh in Waco, Texas, and so many other. Why we don't say, you know, that the Christian bodies has to condemn this? Why don't we see? Why don't we held in the same measure, you know, when Rabbi Kahana, you know, with his total hate sentiments, and the Hebron Mosque massacre of 40 Muslim worshiping, why don't we ask the Jewish community to apologize for such a thing? We should really not equate violence with any religion. Nowadays, here, while we are here enjoying a nice discussion, Burmese Muslims, the Rohingyas Muslims, are slaughtered by so-called Buddhist, you know, monks in modern day. But we don't ask, you know, the Buddhists worldwide to condemn such behavior. So let us be, not to be double standards, not to be hypocrites, you know, and accept that Muslims do condemn. Yes, we do have our rotten apples, but so do everybody have their own rotten apples.
KBOO's Chris Andre spoke after the event with Hama Miazad, a lab instructor at the Child Development Center at Portland Community College and a member of the Muslim Educational Trust Outreach Committee.
I think my resolution is to get involved, you know, and I think not just for causes of for Muslim and women, I think for causes of anyone. And I think that's been like the biggest biggest change for me when I see African Americans being, you know, I don't want to be that person that shakes my head and says that's terrible, I disagree with that. I want to be the one there with the signs and petitioning and calling. I think, and the same thing with, you know, for gay lesbian issues or for any issues where someone is being oppressed. I think the Muslim community is kind of shook by all these events, and I think there's going to be a change because it was forced. It was forced, and they see the sense of urgency in it now. You don't have a choice. You have to speak up. We're part of this country. We're proud to be Americans, and we need to exercise that. I think, you know, the positive side of all these horrible things that's going on, I think as Muslims we're going to start being in the front and being involved as being an American, you know, Americans, because up to now we've always been involved in citizenship, but not speaking up and declaring our patriotism, and, you know, because we are still treated as not being American. You're Muslim and American doesn't go hand in hand in the media, you know. My dream is that will be changed for my children.
That was Hama Miazad at the Portland City Club this afternoon.
Newly released emails show that Michigan Governor Rick Snyder lied when he told the people of Flint, Michigan that their water was safe to drink. According to the leaked emails, the governor knew that the water had dangerous levels of lead and other chemicals months ago, but continued to assure residents that it was safe to drink until this Wednesday when he declared a state of emergency. The elevated lead levels began when Flint switched water sources in April 2014 to cut costs. That move was made after the city's local elected government was deposed by an appointed emergency manager. At the time, Republican Governor Rick Snyder approved the appointment of the emergency manager, along with other Michigan cities. This move was criticized by local residents as a corporate takeover of their cities. The emergency managers immediately took steps to privatize key public resources like water. The residents began experiencing health problems, including rashes, loss of hair, and other severe physical side effects. The governor continued to maintain that the water was safe until earlier this week, when he declared the state of emergency. He refused to admit when he knew the problem with the water.
Arguments for the case Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association are set to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this Monday. The case is another in a series of legal challenges throughout the country targeting public sector unions in recent years. The issue surrounding Monday's case deals with whether mandatory union fees violate the First Amendment. In response, nurses from Washington to California will gather on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court Monday morning to warn that relaxing the union fee system further poses a significant threat to public health. David Kesters of KBOO News speaks to Ken Zinn of National Nurses United.
I'm speaking with Ken Zinn of the National Nurses United Union about the upcoming Supreme Court case, Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. Thank you for speaking with us today, Mr. Zinn.
Happy to do so.
To begin, could you tell us about the National Nurses United and what your union represents?
Sure. We are the largest organization of registered nurses in the United States, representing about 185,000 RNs from coast to coast. Our members are patient advocates at the bedside. They are patient advocates in the community, and the union represents them in collective bargaining, you know, in terms of wages and working conditions, but also in the larger public sphere to advocate for the things that nurses believe in, which is the nurses' values of compassion and community and caring.
Regarding the case that the Supreme Court is hearing this Monday, how does Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association affect your union?
Well, in particular, it impacts nurses who work in public sector hospitals, right? So this case was brought as a challenge by far-right anti-union groups to challenge the right of public sector unions to require all employees who receive the benefits of representation to pay their fair share of the cost of representation. So this is an attempt by those far-right groups to weaken unions. When nurses' unions are weakened, it means that nurses don't have the same protection in order to advocate for our patients that they need in the hospital, and that, therefore, is a threat to patient safety and health.
You mentioned in your press release about how there's already established law that permits employees who object to a union's political expenditures to withhold payment for certain political activity. Now, why do you think the case potentially allowing union members the ability to opt out of dues entirely for politics is an overreach?
It's an overreach because, as you just pointed out, I mean, if the issue is simply not liking any particular union's political positions, then union members already have the right to opt out. In terms of the percentage of the dues that are paid to for political activity. But to say that people who get the benefits of representation, because under the labor law, unions are required to represent all workers, regardless of whether they pay union dues or not, to have them opt out of paying any kind of fee means that the unions will be weakened, and the ability of, in our case, of nurses in public hospitals to speak out on behalf of our patients will be undermined.
So what do you say to workers who argue, as in the case being heard in the Supreme Court, that the issue is whether or not they have a right to choose to be in the union at all?
Well, they do have a right to choose to be in the union at all, and that's decided by Democratic majority rule. So that's how things work in this country. When we vote in elections, for example, for President of the United States, the majority theoretically decides who's the president. The minority who voted for his opponent don't opt out of government. They simply understand that that's how democracy works, majority rules. So that's the same way that labor law works. Majority rules, the majority in any given workplace will decide whether they want to be in a union or not. If the majority says they don't want to be in the union, they are already avenues available to them to opt out of the union.
Tell me about your protest that you've organized next Monday.
Yeah, well, we're going to be there with other union members, but we've got nurses who are going to be there from different parts of the country because they understand what's at stake. Again, it's not just the union itself that's at stake. It's their ability as registered nurses to be a collective voice for their patients. And that's important in patient safety, because if you don't have nurses at the bedside who are advocating for the patients, and in non-union hospitals, they are often intimidated by management not to stand up for their patients, then it's a very dangerous situation for those patients.
How hopeful is your union in regarding the case that's being heard?
I really can't make a prediction, but obviously that it's being heard at all is a concern to us, and we hope that the court will see the reason. And this has been established law for many, many years, and they should continue with the current law as it is, because it's fair, it's correct, and it provides the right balance for all workers in public workforces.
What is the National Nurses United feelings on the state of unions in the country today? What with, I guess, with issues like in Wisconsin and other things that are happening, I guess, what's your take on it?
Well, the labor movement's under attack, very clearly. Wisconsin is an example. This case, Friedrichs, is an example. Other attempts to impose right to work laws in certain states is an example. This is an attempt by very far-right anti-union forces and the top 1% in this country, who own all the wealth and income, to try to beat back the ability of workers to have a collective voice. It's something that we've got to stand up against, and that's why we're protesting.
All right, well, thank you for speaking with us today and expressing the concerns that your union is having about the case being heard by the Supreme Court this Monday. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
And that was Ken Zinn speaking on behalf of the National Nurses United Union. For KBOO News, I'm David Kesters.
The mother of Sandra Bland, who was found dead in a Texas jail cell last year, says that the indictment of the officer who arrested her daughter on a charge of perjury is an injustice. She believes that the trooper and the other officers involved in her daughter's death should be charged with murder. Trooper Brian Encinia was indicted Wednesday by a grand jury for lying about his confrontation with Sandra Bland. The traffic stop was captured on a cell phone camera, and the video evidence contradicts